Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this pre-recorded program very remote from Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Monday, October 12, 2020. South Sudan proposes currency exchange.
What we know is that there is a lack of money, and this is why there is lack of liquidity, and that's why we decided to take the currency.
And Japan donates millions of dollars for families affected by floods in Sudan.
The swarm came to Sudan, did one of the heaviest damages, and we recognized that the harm done to Sudan would be so severe that it could cause serious malnutrition to a number of people. We've decided to provide the emergency grant aid in order to quickly respond to the needs of affected population.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Some South Sudanese economists say the government's decision to replace the South Sudan pound with a new currency will not save the country from economic crisis. A lecturer of economics at the University of Juba says introducing a new currency will not change the situation. He says the government should introduce new banking policies to regulate the operations of commercial banks in South Sudan. For VOA News, Onen Walter Solomon reports from Juba.
Information Minister Michael McQuaid told South Sudan in Focus said the decision was made to introduce a new currency because too many people are holding on to their cash. As a result, he says, there is not enough money in markets across the country.
What we know is that there is hoarding of money, and this is why there is lack of liquidity, and that's why we decided to take the currency.
McQuaid says the new currency will be introduced as soon as all preparations are completed. He said it will also be a South Sudanese pound, but will be different than the one currently in circulation. He did not provide details other than to say the difference would be technical. Harmit Morjan, a lecturer of economics at the University of Juba, says introducing a new currency will not solve South Sudan's serious economic problems.
That doesn't mean that it is anti-inflationary measure. It is just trying to restore the level of the supply of the currency when it is now out of control. In our case of South Sudan, you have a problem in the exchange rate market where, you know, there is always escalation. In other words, the pound is losing its value. Therefore, an assumption of this kind will sometimes have what we call exceptional impact on the people. Those who are holding the local currencies may now rush even to start buying the little hard currency which is the market, and may further escalate the exchange rate, and in the end, again, will bring about some more hyperinflation.
Morjan says the government should ensure that the banking system operates under the control of the central bank in a transparent manner so that people gain confidence in the country's banking system rather than hoarding their money at home.
The only way to have more money is to pay interest on people's deposits, and then you make the banking operation so safe and convenient and effective so that people are at least convinced to put their money in the bank. So people cannot be forced to put their money in the bank unless there are some good policies.
Morjan says South Sudanese have lost confidence in the efficiency of the banking system because it takes at least 2 hours for a customer to deposit money into an account and several hours to withdraw cash from the same account. Abraham Matoch, economics professor and vice chancellor at Bor-based Dr. John Garang Memorial University of Science and Technology, says people who obtain money through dubious transactions are ashamed to deposit it in their bank accounts and prefer to keep it in their houses. Matoch also says some South Sudanese doubt that peace will last in the country and hoard the money for that reason.
The issue of confidence is based on the fact that the banks now in a peace period, there is no problem. They themselves will even invest. You can even invest in depositing your money in your bank accounts and works with interest. And with the reforms now, when the money change, there will actually be restrictions and there will be regulations backing up the reform.
Mariola Woyol, another economics professor and vice-chancellor of Upper Nile University, says changing the currency is aimed at boosting the already struggling microeconomic activity in the market. Woyol says there is need to reform every level of the economy in the country.
currency must be into them. They must know how much currency they have. I mean, when you talk about financing the deficit, you should be able to know how much currency you have in the circulation so that you release the next round of money. But now, I'm told about 80%, if not more, is outside the banking system.
Makwe says the government has formed a committee comprised of government ministers and representatives of commercial banks and central bank officials to study the matter and report back to the cabinet within 7 days. For VOA News, I am Onan Walter Solomon in Juba.
Some schools in South Sudan's capital Juba are preparing to fight the spread of COVID-19 as schools reopened last week. Some school administrators say they are not sure if they will afford to sustain the World Health Organization's guidelines because some parents cannot afford to buy sanitizers for their children. For VOA News, Ding Magot reports from Juba.
At Juba Diocesan Model Secondary School, all staff and students are required to wear face masks while on the school compound. Everyone is expected to wash their hands with soap at the entrance. At the center of the compound sits another water container where teachers and students wash their hands, and other hand washing facilities are stationed in front of each classroom and near the headmaster's office. Classes are also divided to reduce overcrowding. Before the COVID-19 outbreak, each class accommodated 65 students. Now there is more than 30 in each class where students sit 1.5 meters apart. And every student must carry a hand sanitizer. The school's head teacher, K. Robert Tomor, worries some schools might run out of resources.
Some of these challenges will need the cooperation from the parents and then the Ministry of Education and Health, that once in a while they need to come in and support the schools, because the school may not be financially well, because most of the schools depend on what parents contribute. And without any external support, they will reach a point where the schools will really feel the pressure.
Juba Diocesan Model Secondary School biology teacher Lukudu Philip Emmanuel says some students may not be able to buy hand sanitizers and face masks.
The day when we started calling the parents, some of them, for sure, they don't have any money to get a hand sanitizer for the child, maybe even sometimes the face mask, because at the moment we are in the time of the pandemic, our economy is down, and I'm sure they are really running a serious problem in the families.
Germano Lado Swaka, a teacher of religious studies at Juba 1 Primary School, says a local NGO donated hand washing facilities and hand sanitizers to the school.
NGO actually is very nice for us. They are really taking their part. I think they brought us barrel for washing. Yeah. And then simply what is we are making, because maybe soap, because we need to be buy money if there's no money.
Now that classes are divided into smaller streams, Swaka says some teachers will be overwhelmed tending to all the different classes. Bridget Juru Emmanuel, a senior 4 student and head girl at Juba Diocesan Model Secondary School, complains it's difficult to breathe while wearing a face mask and says the price of hand sanitizers is not cheap.
This issue of sanitizer, it's hard to find because about the crisis issue, it's really high, and then buying it at the market is so expensive.
Juru says coping up with the studies is also a challenge because there are many notes to catch up with. Students were learning at home during COVID-19 before officials ordered schools to reopen on Monday. Minister of General Education and Instruction, Awut Deng Achwil, said last week her ministry would provide schools with hand sanitizers and hand washing facilities.
In order to adhere to COVID-19 protocols, the ministry has to prepare the school to reopen safely. In this respect, we prioritize the wash facilities in schools, such as water and soap, to enable children and teachers to wash their hands. In some schools that have no access to water, we are going to to dig the borehole to provide water. Also, the students and teachers will have to wear face masks.
Achuil also says temperatures of students and staff will also be monitored each morning before classes begin. Students have 135 days to complete the syllabus this year, which means they have 6 days of studying per week. For VOA News, I am Ding Magot in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Khartoum, where Japan has donated $1.7 million to the United Nations World Food Program to support families in eastern Sudan. WFP says thousands of Sudanese in the eastern part of the country lost their livelihoods and are at risk because desert locusts destroyed their crops. WFP officials say some 78,000 families in Kassala and Red Sea State will benefit from the Japanese donation. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Khartoum.
WFP officials in Sudan say the money will be used to provide food rations for 3 months for more than 78,000 eastern Sudanese residents who are food insecure. The WFP say it will buy and distribute sorghum, lentils, and vegetable oil, along with other items, to the most affected population of Kassala and Red Sea states. WFP country director in Sudan, Hamid Nuru, told South Sudan in Focus via WhatsApp in Khartoum that the WFP is working closely with local governments and stakeholders to identify the most vulnerable populations in these locations to ensure that those who are most in need receive urgent support. Nuru praised the government and the people of Japan for what he calls a generous contribution, saying the funds will mitigate the worst effects of multiple crises and ensure that men, women, and children who are hit the hardest get the life-saving food they need.
In the Red Sea state, however, the prices of sorghum has risen by nearly 250% between July 2019 and July 2020. In 2020, Sudan's humanitarian needs have continued to increase, driven by protracted conflict and displacement, natural disasters such as the floods right now, epidemics, malnutrition, and food security.
Nuru says Japan's contribution comes at a critical time when food insecurity in Sudan is at an all-time high, with 9.6 million people projected to be food insecure at the peak of the lean season, according to IPC Food Security. The WFP official says the coronavirus pandemic, along with this year's locust swarm, have further worsened the situation.
In Kassala State in particular, farmers who had started to sow or grow their sorghum were affected by fuel shortages and access to tractors and labor to work in their fields. Some localities have lost availability of certain sorghum varieties due to stock depletion. COVID-19 also pushed people further into poverty by reducing the amount they can spend on nutrient-dense food.
As a result, Nuru says malnutrition in Kassala State increased by 43% in June compared to previous months this year. Takashi Haturi, the Japanese ambassador to Sudan, says the government and the people of Japan recognize the severe damage caused by the locust infestation in Sudan, especially in the midst of the pandemic. Speaking to South Sudan in Focus, Atsuo Okada, an officer in charge of the economic cooperation at the Japanese embassy in Khartoum, says stability of agricultural activities in Sudan is one of the projects Japan is supporting, which is why the Japanese government decided to intervene.
The swarm came to Sudan, did one of the heaviest damages, and we recognized that the harm done to Sudan would be so severe that it could cause serious malnutrition to a number of people. We've decided to provide the emergency grant aid in order to quickly respond to the needs of affected population, considering that we are putting emphasis on the development and stability of agricultural productivity in Sudan as one of the pillars of our cooperation to this country.
Okada says Japan has more than 15 bilateral ongoing projects in Sudan, including operating a water purification facilities in White Nile, clearing mines with NGOs in various war-affected areas, and offering help for vocational training to young Sudanese. He says Japan also funds 7 other UN organizations in various states that provide support and protection of vulnerable refugees and IDPs in Darfur, sanitation support in Blue Nile and South Kordofan, and other projects.
We have recently provided $3.6 million to UNDP and UNICEF to deliver medical kits to combat the COVID-19 pandemic in Sudan. And last month, we provided emergency relief goods such as tents and sleeping bags in response to the flood disaster in Khartoum.
WFP officials say financial support from countries like Japan will help alleviate the suffering of the Sudanese people and avert the worst impacts of multiple challenges gripping Sudan, including its economic crisis. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, a retired South African colonel says his country is to blame for the crisis in South Sudan. That story is coming up right after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
how do you correct friends and loved ones?
I tell them the truth, because when I hide it, sometimes I have to tell them again and explain, which is not so fun. Yeah, it's easier for everyone.
You tell him what you have done is wrong. Next time, don't do like this, according to what he has done.
The first step I do actually is that I talk to the person. I sit back a little bit to be able to ascertain if it really went down with the person. To give the person a breathing space, just to ponder about whatever I said. And in the course of time, to allow process to have its way.
When they go wrong, I call them aside and talk to them. I tell them their behavior is very bad, so they need to stay away from it. And some of them get angry, but I don't care.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
VOA always delivers your favorite programs, news, music, entertainment, and sports shows. Starting Monday, October 5th, our flagship news show, South Sudan in Focus, will be moving to 16:30 UTC, followed by your favorite sports show, The Sunny Side of Sports, at 1700 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Kenya, like other African countries, is trying out their phased reopening of schools. Primary and secondary school students are expected to report to school today after 7 months of coronavirus closure. As Atieno Odhiambo reports from Nairobi, some schools and parents are upbeat about the reopening.
Cabinet Secretary for Education Professor George Magoha said last week that the government was testing the waters with the return of these 3 grades, and if successful, the remaining grades will be allowed back in school.
We have opened schools in the very strict hope that we will succeed and that we shall recoup the year which otherwise would have been lost. I've also said that we are going to observe these 3 classes, and if there is no big issue, then after thorough stakeholder consultation and government consultation, we shall reopen the rest of the schools.
However, Peter Ndoro, Chief Executive Officer of the Kenya Private Schools Association, says 196 private schools have since closed, affecting 54,000 learners and 1,300 teaching and non-teaching staff. He says some private schools have closed because they could not afford the rent. Other schools have been inundated by floods that have recently engulfed parts of the country. Other schools' owners converted their schools to more profitable businesses. Joseph Maina, the director of Mwea Brethren Primary School, says he converted his classrooms into a chicken farm.
After the COVID-19 broke in March, I found myself in a dilemma. So I decided to start some business which would take care of my family. That is how I ended up starting. I was not prepared about the opening of the school by now. See, I had set myself by January where I could have even disposed of some of the chicks. But somehow, I have tried to reorganize once again, put some chicks on one side, and the other side I put some classes. But if it so happens that the whole school is going to open, let me be very sincere, I will not open.
Some parents have also expressed the opposition to the decision to reopen schools, citing that they are not prepared and that the one-week notice was too short. They also say they do not have money for school fees as their income has been greatly affected by the pandemic. Emmanuel Odhiambo has two children in grade 4 and 8.
To the Minister of Education, this is something that is actually sort of a mixed feeling for myself, because on the one hand, I want my kids to be back in school, but there's also the reality that there are fees to be paid, and we'd actually been psychologically prepared for January next year, because all along we had actually said as much. And so this, you know, very short notice actually, you know, came as a shocker to us, because we have to look for fees in a few days' time and have kids back school, and that's really going to be tough. You know, speaking from my own, you know, perspective, because I know the challenge that I'm facing.
As the students return to class, the ministry has instructed all schools to ensure mandatory use of face masks, monitoring of body temperature for all learners, staff, and all other persons accessing the schools, hand washing, and observance of high levels of hygiene. The education ministry has acknowledged that physical distancing will remain a challenge. However, it said this should not be enough reason to keep students away from school. Atieno Odhiambo, VOA in Nairobi, Kenya.
The Daily Maverick of South Africa has reviewed a book on South Sudan entitled No Justice, No Mercy, A Story of South Sudan. The author of the book, retired Colonel William John Anley, who was sentenced to death in South Sudan and later released by a presidential pardon, says his book reveals some personal vested interest of some South African officials into South Sudan's affairs. Anley says he believes personal interest of some top ANC leaders and their bias towards President Salva Kiir prolong the conflict in South Sudan. He says his book has shed more light on South Africa's interference in South Sudan's conflict.
He was representing, number one, as the deputy president or vice president of South Africa. Number two, he was representing his political party. And then number three, he was supposed to mediate within the issues within the SPLM and to help resolve the conflict. And that did not happen. I refer to a meeting that took place between him and Thabang Guy down in Cape Town, where it was blatantly stated that the reason for the war was Dr. Mashar, and at the same time that if he was not involved in the peace process, peace would come to South Sudan. And that is where the two deputies decided they would support their number ones or the presidents and try to resolve the problem, which did not happen. So, you know, the fact that Dr. Mashar was kept for the peace process, the negotiation process, did not help. In fact, I believe it worsened the problem in South Sudan.
You implicated the Obama administration by saying that they were part of the move to block Riek Machar out of South Sudan. Do you have any tangible evidence to show that indeed the Obama administration was part of the move to block Machar from entering South Sudan?
From the research that I did, and again, you know, nothing would be on paper, many telephone calls were made to different countries in the region and on the continent. For example, Dr. Riek Machar was going to go back to Ethiopia, and from there he was going to Nigeria, and all these entries, etc., were blocked. The countries were told not to accept him, and at the end of the day, he was forced to return to South Africa. He had no choice in that matter. And that is where he was put as a guest. I put that in little funny marks, but he came here as a guest for almost 2 years, in which he was kept out of all negotiations, kept out of the peace process, and even visitors were kept away from him.
How would you react to some critics who would say you are supporting Dr. Riek Machar just because he gave you some assignment where you were able to make some money?
I have a very personal friendship and relationship with Dr. Mashar. I was working pro bono for him because I wanted to get back to South Sudan and I wanted to get involved in the peace process, and most important, the integration of the defense force on that side. So, yes, I am a supporter of Dr. Mashar as an individual, and I believe he has the solution for South Sudan, and this has got nothing to do with money. I still have not been paid anything since 2015.
It is an open secret that former South African military officials have been used across the continent as what a lot of researchers are calling mercenaries. Were you a mercenary in South Sudan?
Yeah. Well, a mercenary, the definition of a mercenary has become very blurred over the years. And a mercenary is someone who takes up arms not for a cause, not to assist, but to be paid, but at the same time to achieve a mission. My mission or responsibility, I still see, is to assist with the integration of the SSPDF and the IO forces. I believe we have the experience and we can play a role in doing that. So the word mercenary is contentious. At the same time, I think it's been pulled completely out of context.
It appears like your attachment to South Sudan is not going anywhere after you were locked in Blue House for a year or so, sentenced to death, freed on a presidential pardon, and you're still talking about South Sudan. What is it in for you when it comes to the issues of South Sudan?
Hello, John. Yes. Well, I have spent a long time from 2007 involved in humanitarian demining. I've made many, many friends that I've kept over the years. And I've developed a soft spot or an interest in the country. So yes, I believe the country has not got not even close to its potential. There's room for potential to develop the country, and the only way to do that is to get stability in the security sector.
What do you plan to do in the next 1 or 2 years? Are you still focused on South Sudan?
John, at this point in time, I've been working with business partners or setting up a new business with people in South Africa. We're looking at the region, and at the same time, we're looking at South Africa, doing various consultancies. And I'm looking at capacity building and also to go back into humanitarian UN-type demining operations. So we are in process of doing that during this coronavirus period.
In the discussion on the review of your book, the name of Vice President Thabang Dengai kept coming up. It appears like you were not happy with Thabang Dengai during the time you were locked up in South Sudan. What went wrong? It appears like you were good friends.
No, completely incorrect. In fact, we met a few times in Addis, and when I arrived back with Dr. Mashaw on the airplane, the first person I greeted was Thabang. And I still cannot understand and believe the way that he turned and changed towards me, because up until then we really got on well. Well, I believe that we did. But the complete change, and for example, refusing to come to court, as the same with Ezekiel Gatkus, who I worked with in Addis, it still made no sense. And the fact that I was part of Dr. Mashal's group is for sure. But I never had a personal problem with either of them.
That's retired Colonel John Anley, author of the book No Justice, No Mercy, A Story of South Sudan. He spoke with me from Johannesburg last week. Before we end this show, I have a special announcement for you. This program can now be heard in South Sudan at 7:30 p.m. local time on VOA affiliate stations. Please inform your friends and relatives. That's all we prepared for you this Monday. We now leave you with the song Mungu Si by J.M. Kennedy. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for being part of our evening. Remember to wash your hands with soap, practice social distancing, and wear a mask if you must leave your home. Do not escape from COVID-19 quarantine centers because there is no cure for coronavirus. Join us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Nyowalusia izi mungu ni kwa katedre warungoni ti atole mungu si nyowalusia watipila izi mungu ni kwa katedre warungoni ti atole mungu si nyowalusia izi mungu ni kwa katedre warungoni ti atole mungu si katro walioniti Katro wazoniti, katro bakoniti, zimungu matia. Katro walioniti, katro wazoniti, katro bakoniti, zimungu matia. Kondwa konia, fizi akonia, azi akonia, mungu nifera. Kondwa konia, fizi akonia. Zia konia, mungu ni fera. Mio wadusia,
see.